Part 2, Chapter 19. Thomas Robinson reached around, ran his fingers under his left arm, and lifted it. He guided his arm to the Bible, and his rubber-like left hand sought contact with the black binding. As he raised his right hand, the useless one slipped off the Bible and hit the clerk's table. He was trying again when Judge Taylor growled, "That'll do, Tom." Tom took the oath and stepped into the witness chair. Atticus very quickly introduced him to everyone. Tom was 25 years of age. He was married with 3 children. He had been in trouble with the law before. He once received 30 days of disorderly conduct. "It must have been disorderly," said Atticus. "What did it consist of?" "Got in a fight with another man. He tried to cut me."
"Did he succeed?"
"Yes, sir. A little. Not enough to hurt. You see, I..." Tom moved his left shoulder.
"Yes," said Atticus. "You were both convicted?"
"Yes, sir. I had to serve because I couldn't pay the fine. Other fellow paid his'n."
Dill leaned across me and asked Jim what Atticus was doing. Jim said Atticus was showing the jury that Tom had nothing to hide.
"Were you acquainted with Mayella Violet Ewell?" asked Atticus.
"Yes, sir. I had to pass her place going to and from the field every day."
"Whose field?"
"I picks for Mr. Link D's."
"Were you picking cotton in November?"
"No, sir. I works in his yard fall and winter time. I works pretty steady for him all year round. He's got a lot of pecan trees and things."
"You say you had to pass the Ewell place to get to and from work. Is there any other way to go?"
"No, sir. None's I know of."
"Tom, did she ever speak to you?"
"Why, yes, sir. I tip my hat when I go by, and one day she asked me to come inside the fence and bust up a shiffer robe for her."
"When did she ask you to chop up the shiffer robe?"
"Mr. Finch, it was way last spring. I remember it because it was chopping time, and I had my hoe with me. I said I didn't have nothing but this hoe, but she said she had a hatchet. She gave me the hatchet, and I broke up the shiffer robe. She said, 'I reckon I'll have to give you a nickel, won't I?' And I said, 'No, ma'am, there ain't no charge.' Then I went home." "Mr. Finch, that was way last spring, way over a year ago."
"Did you ever go on the place again?"
"Yes, sir."
"When?"
"Well, I went lots of times."
Judge Taylor instinctively reached for his gavel, but let his hand fall. The murmur below us died without his help.
"Under what circumstances?"
"Please, sir?"
"Why did you go inside the fence lots of times?"
Tom Robinson's forehead relaxed.
"She'd call me in, sir. Seemed like every time I passed by yonder, she'd have a little something little for me to do. Chopping kindling, toting water for her. She watered them red flowers every day."
"Were you paid for your services?"
"No, sir. Not after she offered me a nickel the first time, I was glad to do it. Mr. Ewell didn't seem to help her none, and neither did the chillen, and I know she didn't have no nickels to spare."
"Where were the other children?"
"They was always around, all over the place. They'd watch me work. Some of them sat in the window."
"Would Miss Mayella talk to you?"
"Yes, sir. She talked to me."
As Tom Robinson gave his testimony, it came to me that Mayella Ewell must have been the loneliest person in the world. She was even lonelier than Boo Radley, who had not been out of the house in 25 years. When Atticus asked if she had any friends, she seemed not to know what he meant. Then she thought he was making fun of her. She was as sad, I thought, as when Jim called a mixed child. White people wouldn't have anything to do with her because she lived among pigs. Negroes wouldn't have anything to do with her because she was white. She couldn't live like Mr. Dolphus Raymond, who preferred the company of Negroes, because she didn't own a river bank, and she wasn't from a fine old family. Nobody said that's just their way about the Ewells. Maycomb gave them Christmas baskets well for money in the back of its hand. Tom Robinson was probably the only person who was ever decent to her, but she said he took advantage of her, and when she stood up, she looked at him as if he were dirt beneath her feet. "Did you ever," Atticus interrupted my meditations, "at any time go on the Ewell property, did you ever set foot on the Ewell property without an express invitation from one of them?"
"No, sir, Mr. Finch, I never did. I wouldn't do that, sir."
Atticus sometimes said that one way to tell whether a witness was lying or telling the truth was to listen rather than watch. I applied his test. Tom denied it 3 times in one breath, but quietly, with no hint of whining in his voice, and I found myself believing him in spite of his protesting too much. He seemed to be a respectable Negro, and a respectable Negro would never go up into somebody's yard of his own volition. "Tom, what happened to you on the evening of November 21st of last year?" Below us, the spectators drew a collective breath and leaned forward. Behind us, the Negroes did the same. Tom was a black velvet Negro, not shiny, but soft black velvet. The whites of his eyes shone in his face, and when he spoke, we saw flashes of his teeth. If he had been whole, he would have been a fine specimen of a man. "Mr. Finch," he said, "I was going home as usual that evening, and when I passed the Ewell place, Miss Mayella were out on the porch, like she says she were. It seemed real quiet-like, and I didn't know why. I was studying why, just passing by, when she says for me to come there and help her a minute.
Well, I went inside the fence and looked around for some kindling to work on, but I didn't see none. And she says, "No, I got something for you to do in the house. The old door's off its hinges and fall's coming on pretty fast." I said, "You got a screwdriver, Miss Mayella?" She said she sure had. Well, I went up the steps and she motioned me to come inside, and I went in the front room and looked at the door. I said, "Miss Mayella, this door looks all right." I pulled it back and forth and those hinges was all right. Then she shut the door in my face. Mr. Finch, I was wondering why it was so quiet-like, and it come to me then that there weren't a child on the place, not one of them. And I said, "Miss Mayella, where are the children?" Tom's black velvet skin had begun to shine, and he ran his hand over his face. I say, "Where are the chillin'?" he continued, and she says, she was laughing, sort of. She says, "They've all gone to town to get ice creams." She says, "Took me a slap year to save 7 nickels, but I done it. They all gone to town." Tom's discomfort was not from the humidity. "What did you say then?" Tom asked Atticus. I said something like, "Why, Miss Mayella, that's so smart of you to treat him." And she said, "You think so?" I don't think she understood what I was thinking. I meant it was smart of her to save like that and nice of her to treat him. "I understand you, Tom. Go on," said Atticus. "Well, I said I'd best be going. I couldn't do nothing for her." And she says, "Oh, yes, I could." And I ask her what. And she says to just step on that chair yonder and get that box down from off the top of the shiffer robe. "Not the same shiffer robe you busted up?" asked Atticus. The witness smiled. "No, sir, another one. Most as tall as the room, so I done what she told me. And I was just reaching when the next thing I know, she grabbed me around the legs, Mr. Finch. She scared me so bad I hopped down and turned the chair over. That was the only thing, only furniture served in that room, Mr. Finch. When I left it, I swear for God." "What happened after you turned the chair over?" Tom Robinson had come to a dead stop. He glanced at Atticus, then at the jury, then at Mr. Underwood sitting across the room. "Tom, you're sworn to tell the whole truth. Will you tell it?" Tom ran his hand nervously over his mouth. "What happened after that?" "Answer the question," said Judge Taylor. One third of his cigar had vanished. "Mr. Finch, I got down off of that chair and turned around and she sort of jumped on me."
"Jumped on you? Violently?"
"No, sir. She hugged me. She hugged me around the waist." This time, Judge Taylor's gavel came down with a bang, and as it did, the overhead lights went on in the courtroom. Darkness had not come, but the afternoon sun had left the windows. Judge Taylor quickly restored order. "Then what did she do?" The witness swallowed hard. "She reached up and kissed me on the side of the face. She says she never kissed a grown man before, and she might as well kiss a nigger. She says what her papa do to her don't count. She says, 'Kiss me back, nigger.' I say, 'Miss Mayella, let me out of here,' and tried to run, but she got her back to the door, and I had to push her. I didn't want to harm her, Mr. Finch, and I say, 'Let me pass.' But just when I say it, Mr. Ewell yonder hollered through the window."
"What did he say?"
Tom Robinson swallowed again, and his eyes widened. "Something not fitting to say, not fitting for these folks and children to hear."
"What did he say, Tom? You must tell the jury."
Tom Robinson shut his eyes tight. "He says, 'You goddamn whore, I'll kill you.'"
"Then what happened?"
"Mr. Finch, I was running so fast, I don't know what happened."
"Tom, did you rape Mayella Ewell?"
"I did not, sir."
"Did you harm her in any way?"
"I did not, sir."
"Did you resist her advances?"
"Mr. Finch, I tried. I tried to, thought being ugly to her. I didn't want to be ugly. I didn't want to push her or nothing."
It occurred to me that in their own way, Tom Robinson's manners were as good as Atticus's. Until my father explained it to me later, I did not understand the subtlety of Tom's predicament. He would not have dared strike a white woman under any circumstance and expect to live long, so he took the first opportunity to run, a sure sign of guilt.
"Tom, go back once more to Mr. Ewell," said Atticus. "Did he say anything to you?"
"Not anything, sir. He might have said something, but I weren't there."
"That'll do," Atticus cut in sharply. "What did you hear? Who was he talking to?"
"Mr. Finch. He were talking and looking at Miss Mayella."
"Then you ran?"
"I sure did, sir."
"Why did you run?"
"I was scared, sir."
"Why were you scared?"
"Mr. Finch, if you was a nigger like me, you'd be scared, too."
Atticus sat down. Mr. Gilmer was making his way to the witness stand, but before he got there, Mr. Linkdees rose from the audience and announced, "I just want the whole lot of you to know one thing right now. That boy's worked for me 8 years, and I ain't had a speck of trouble out of him. Not a speck."
"Shut your mouth, sir." Judge Taylor was wide awake and roaring. He was also pink in the face. His speech was miraculously unimpaired by his cigar.
"Linkdees," he yelled, "if you have anything you want to say, you can say it under oath and at the proper time. But until then, you get out of this room, you hear me? Get out of this room, sir, you hear me? I'll be damned if I'll listen to this case again." Judge Taylor looked daggers at Atticus as if daring him to speak, but Atticus had ducked his head and was laughing into his lap. I remembered something he had said about Judge Taylor's ex-cathedra remarks sometimes exceeding his duty, but that few lawyers ever did anything about them. I looked at Jim, but Jim shook his head. "It ain't like one of the jurymen got up and started talking," he said. "I think it'd be different then. Mr. Link was just disturbing the peace or something." Judge Taylor told the reporter to expunge anything he happened to have written down after Mr. Finch. "If you were a nigger like me, you'd be scared too," and told the jury to disregard the interruption. He looked suspiciously down the middle aisle and waited, I suppose for Mr. Link D's to effect total departure. Then he said, "Go ahead, Mr. Gilmer." "You were given 30 days once for disorderly conduct, Robinson," asked Mr. Gilmer. "Yes, sir." "What'd the nigger look like when you got through with him?"
"He beat me, Mr. Gilmer."
"Yes, but you were convicted, weren't you?" Atticus raised his head. "It was a misdemeanor, and it's in the record, Judge. I thought he sounded tired."
"Witness will answer, though," said Judge Taylor just as wearily.
"Yes, sir. I got 30 days."
I knew that Mr. Gilmer would sincerely tell the jury that anyone who was convicted of disorderly conduct could easily have had it in his heart to take advantage of Mayella Ewell. That was the only reason he cared. Reasons like that helped.
"Robinson, you're pretty good at busting up chifferobes and kindling with one hand, aren't you?"
"Yes, sir. I reckon so."
"Strong enough to choke the breath out of a woman and sling her to the floor?"
"I've never done that, sir."
"But you're strong enough to?"
"I reckon so, sir."
"Had your eye on her a long time, hadn't you, boy?"
"No, sir. I never looked at her."
"Then you were mighty polite to do all that chopping and hauling for her, weren't you, boy?"
"I was just trying to help her out, sir."
"That was mighty generous of you. You had chores at home after your regular work, didn't you?"
"Yes, sir."
"Why didn't you do them instead of Miss Ewell's?"
"I done them both, sir."
"You must have been pretty busy. Why?"
"Why what, sir?"
"Why were you so anxious to do that woman's chores?"
Tom Robinson hesitated, searching for an answer.
"Looked like she didn't have nobody to help her, like I says."
"With Mr. Ewell and 7 children on the place, boy?"
"Well, I says it looked like they never help her none."
"You did all this chopping and work from sheer goodness, boy?"
"Tried to help her, I says."
Mr. Gilmer smiled grimly at the jury. "You're a mighty good fellow, it seems. Did all this for not one penny?"
"Yes, sir. I felt right sorry for her. She seemed to try more than the rest of them."
"You felt sorry for her? You felt sorry for her?"
Mr. Gilmer seemed ready to rise to the ceiling. The witness realized his mistake and shifted uncomfortably in the chair, but the damage was done. Below us, nobody liked Tom Robinson's answer. Mr. Gilmer paused a long time to let it sink in. "Now, you went by the house as usual last November 21st, he said, "and she asked you to come in and bust up a chifferobe.
"No, sir."
"Do you deny that you went by the house?"
"No, sir.
She had something for me to do inside the house."
"She says she asked you to bust up a chifferobe, is that right?"
"No, sir, it ain't."
"Then you say she's lying, boy?"
Atticus was on his feet, but Tom Robinson didn't need him.
"I don't say she's lying, Mr. Gilmer. I say she's mistaken in her mind."
To the next 10 questions, as Mr. Gilmer reviewed Mayella's version of events, the witness's steady answer was that she was mistaken in her mind.
"Didn't Mr. Ewell run you off the place, boy?"
"No, sir, I don't think he did."
"Don't think? What do you mean?"
"I mean, I didn't stay long enough for him to run me off."
"You're very candid about this. Why did you run so fast?"
"I says I was scared, sir."
"If you had a clear conscience, why were you scared?"
"Like I says before, it weren't safe for any nigger to be in a fix like that."
"But you weren't in a fix. You testified that you were resisting Mrs. Ewell. Were you so scared that she'd hurt you, you ran a big buck like you?"
"No, sir. I scared I'd be in court, just like I am now."
"Scared of arrest? Scared you'd have to face up to what you did?"
"No, sir. Scared I'd have to face up to what I didn't do."
"Are you being impudent to me, boy?"
"No, sir. I didn't go to be."
This was as much as I heard of Mr. Gilmer's cross-examination, because Jim made me take Dill out. For some reason, Dill had started crying and couldn't stop. Quietly at first, then his sobs were heard by several people in the balcony. Jim said if I didn't go with him, he'd make me, and Reverend Sykes said I'd better go, so I went. Dill had seemed to be all right that day, nothing wrong with him, but I guess he hadn't fully recovered from running away. "Aren't you feeling good?" I asked when we reached the bottom of the stairs. Dill tried to pull himself together as we ran down the south steps. Mr. Link Dees was a lonely figure at the top of the steps. "Anything happening, Scout?" he asked as we went by.
"No, sir," I answered over my shoulder.
"Dill here, he's sick."
"Come out under the trees," I said. "Heat got you, I expect." We chose the fattest live oak and we sat under it.
"It was just him I couldn't stand," Dill said.
"Who, Tom?"
That old Mr. Gilmer, doing him that away, talking so hateful to him. Still, that's his job. Why, if we didn't have the prosecutors, well, we couldn't have defense attorneys, I reckon. Dill exhaled patiently. I know all that, Scout. It was the way he said it made me sick. Plain sick. He's supposed to act that way, Dill. He was cross. He didn't act that way when... Dill, those were his own witnesses. Well, Mr. Finch didn't act that way to Mayella and old man Yule when he cross-examined them. The way that man called him boy all the time and sneered at him and looked around the jury every time he answered. Well, Dill, after all, he's just a Negro. I don't care one speck. It ain't right. Somehow, it ain't right to do him that way. Hasn't anybody got any business talking like that? It just makes me sick. That's just Mr. Gilmer's way, Dill. He does them all that way. You've never seen him get good and down on one yet. Why, when, well, today, Mr. Gilmer seemed to me like he wasn't even half trying. They do him all that way, most lawyers, I mean. Mr. Finch doesn't. He's not an example, Dill. He's... I was trying to grope in my memory for a sharp phrase of Miss Maudie Atkinson's. I had it. He's the same in the courtroom as he is on the public streets. That's not what I mean, said Dill. I know what you mean, boy, said a voice behind us. We thought it came from the tree trunk, but it belonged to Mr. Dolphus Raymond. He peered around the trunk at us. You weren't thin-hided. It just makes you sick, doesn't it? Chapter 20. Come on round here, son. I got something that'll settle your stomach. As Mr. Dolphus Raymond was an evil man, I accepted his invitation reluctantly, but I followed Dill. Somehow, I didn't think Atticus would like it if we became friendly with Mr. Raymond, and I knew Aunt Alexandra wouldn't. Here, he said, offering Dill his paper sack with straws in it. Take a good sip. It'll quieten you. Dill sucked on the straw, smiled, and pulled at length. Hee-hee, said Mr. Raymond, evidently taking delight in corrupting a child. Dill, you watch out now, I warn. Dill released the straws and grinned. Scout, it's nothing but Coca-Cola. Mr. Raymond sat up against the tree trunk. He had been lying on the grass. You little folks won't tell on me now, will you? It'd ruin my reputation if you did. You mean all you drink in that sack's Coca-Cola? Just plain Coca-Cola? Yes, ma'am, Mr. Raymond nodded. I liked his smell. It was of leather, horses, cottonseed. He wore the only English riding boots I had ever seen. That's all I drink most of the time. Then you just pretend you're half... I beg your pardon, sir, I caught myself. I didn't mean to be... Mr. Raymond chuckled, not at all offended, and I tried to frame a discreet question. Why do you do like you do? What? Oh, yes, you mean why do I pretend? Well, it's very simple, he said. Some folks don't like the way I live. Now, I could say the hell with them. I don't care if they don't like it. I do say I don't care if they don't like it right enough, but I don't say the hell with them, see? Dill and I said, no, sir. I try to give them a reason, you see. It helps folks that they can latch on to a reason. When I come into town, which is seldom, if I weave a little and drink out of this sack, folks can say Dolphus Raymond's in his clutches of whiskey. That's why he won't change his ways. He can't help himself. That's why he lives the way he does. That ain't honest, Mr. Raymond, making yourself out better than you're already... It ain't honest, but it's mighty helpful to folks. Secretly, Miss Finch, I'm not much of a drinker, but you see, they could never, never understand that I live like I do because that's the way I want to live. I had a feeling that I shouldn't be here listening to this sinful man who had mixed children and didn't care who knew it, but he was fascinating. I had never encountered a being who deliberately perpetrated fraud against himself. But why had he entrusted us with his deepest secret? I asked him why. Because you're children and you can understand it, he said, and because I heard that one... He jerked his head at Dill. Things haven't caught up with that one's instinct yet. Let him get a little older and he won't get sick and cry. Maybe things will strike him as being not quite right, say, but he won't cry, not when he gets a few years on him. Cry about what, Mr. Raymond? Dill's maleness was beginning to assert itself. Cry about simple hell people give other people without even thinking. Cry about the hell white people give colored folks without even stopping to think that they're people too. Atticus says cheating a colored man is 10 times worse than cheating a white man, I muttered. Says it's the worst thing you can do. Mr. Raymond said, I don't reckon it's... Miss Jean Louise, you don't know your pa's not a run-of-the-mill man. It'll take a few years for that to sink in. You haven't seen enough of the world yet. You haven't even seen this town, but all you gotta do is step back inside the courthouse. Which reminded me that we were missing nearly all of Mr. Gilmer's cross-examination. I looked at the sun, and it was dropping fast behind the store tops on the west side of the square. Between two fires, I could not decide which I wanted to jump into, Mr. Raymond or the Fifth Judicial Circuit Court. Come on, Dill, I said. You all right now? Yeah, glad to have met you, Mr. Raymond, and thanks for the drink. It was mighty settling.
We raced back to the courthouse, up the steps, up two flights of stairs, and edged our way along the balcony rail. Reverend Sykes had saved our seats. The courtroom was still, and again, I wondered where the babies were. Judge Taylor's cigar was a brown speck in the center of his mouth. Mr. Gilmore was writing on one of the yellow pads on his table, trying to outdo the court reporter whose hand was jerking rapidly. "Shoot," I muttered, "we missed it." Atticus was halfway through his speech to the jury. He had evidently pulled some papers from his briefcase and rested beside his chair, because they were on his table. Tom Robinson was toying with him. Absence of any corroborative evidence, this man was indicted on a capital charge and is now on trial for his life. I punched Jim. "How long's he been at it?"
"He's just gone over the evidence," Jim whispered, "and we're going to win, Scout. I don't see how we can't. He's been at it about 5 minutes. He's made it as plain and as easy as, well, I'd explain it to you. You could have understood it even."
"Did Mr. Gilmer?"
"Shh. Nothing new. Just the usual. Hush now."
We looked down again. Atticus was speaking easily with the kind of detachment he used when he dictated a letter. He walked slowly up and down in front of the jury, and the jury seemed to be attentive. Their heads were up, and they followed Atticus's route with what seemed to be appreciation. I guess it was because Atticus wasn't a thunderer. Atticus paused, then he did something he didn't ordinarily do. He unhitched his watch and chain and placed them on the table, saying, "With the court's permission..." Judge Taylor nodded, and then Atticus did something I never saw him do before or since, in public or in private. He unbuttoned his vest, unbuttoned his collar, loosened his tie, and took off his coat. He never loosened a scrap of his clothing until he undressed at bedtime, and to Jim and me, this was the equivalent of him standing before us stark naked. We exchanged horrified glances. Atticus put his hands in his pockets as he returned to the jury. I saw his gold collar button and the tips of his pen and pencil winking in the light. "Gentlemen," he said. Jim and I again looked at each other. Atticus might have said "scout." His voice had lost its airity, its detachment, and he was talking to the jury as if they were folks in the post office corner. "Gentlemen," he was saying, "I shall be brief, but I would like to use my remaining time with you to remind you that this case is not a difficult one. It requires no minute sifting of complicated facts, but it does require you to be sure beyond all reasonable doubt as to the guilt of the defendant. To begin with, this case should never have come to trial. This case is as simple as black and white. The state has not produced one iota of medical evidence to the effect that the crime Tom Robinson is charged with ever took place. It has relied instead upon the testimony of two witnesses whose evidence has not only been called into serious question on cross-examination, but has been flatly contradicted by the defendant. The defendant is not guilty, but somebody in this courtroom is. I have nothing but piety in my heart for the chief witness for the state, but my piety does not extend so far as to putting a man's life at stake, which she has done in an effort to get rid of her own guilt. I say guilt, gentlemen, because it was guilt that motivated her. She has committed no crime. She has merely broken a rigid and time-honored code of our society, a code so severe that whoever breaks it is hounded from our midst as unfit to live with. She is the victim of cruel poverty and ignorance, but I cannot pity her. She is white. She knew full well the enormity of her offense, but because her desires were stronger than the code she was breaking, she persisted in breaking it. She persisted, and her subsequent reaction is something that all of us have known at one time or another. She did something every child has done. She tried to put the evidence of her offense away from her. But in this case, she was no child hiding stolen contraband. She struck out at her victim. Of necessity, she must put him away from her. He must be removed from her presence, from this world. She must destroy the evidence of her offense. What was the evidence of her offense? Tom Robinson, a human being. She must put Tom Robinson away from her. Tom Robinson was her daily reminder of what she did. What did she do? She tempted a Negro. She was white, and she tempted a Negro. She did something that in our society is unspeakable. She kissed a black man. Not an old uncle, but a strong young Negro man. No code mattered to her before she broke it, but it came crashing down on her afterwards. Her father saw it, and the defendant has testified as to his remarks. What did her father do? We don't know, but there is circumstantial evidence to indicate that Mayella Ewell was beaten savagely by someone who led almost exclusively with his left. We do know in part what Mr. Ewell did. He did what any God-fearing, persevering, respectable white man would do under the circumstances. He swore out a warrant, no doubt signing it with his left hand, and Tom Robinson now sits before you having taken the oath with the only good hand he possesses, his right hand. And so, a quiet, respectable, humble Negro who had the unmitigated temerity to feel sorry for a white woman has had to put his word against two white people's.
I need not remind you of their appearance and conduct on the stand. You saw them for yourselves. The witnesses for the state, with the exception of the sheriff of Macomb County, have presented themselves to you, gentlemen, to this court, in the cynical confidence that their testimony would not be doubted, confident that you gentlemen would go along with them on the assumption, the evil assumption, that all Negroes lie, that all Negroes are basically immoral beings, that all Negro men are not to be trusted around our women, an assumption one associates with the minds of their caliber. Which, gentlemen, we know is in itself a lie as black as Tom Robinson's skin. A lie I do not have to point out to you. You know the truth, and the truth is this. Some Negroes lie. Some Negroes are immoral. Some Negro men are not to be trusted around women, black or white. But this is a truth that applies to the human race and to no particular race of men. There is not a person in this courtroom who has never told a lie, who has never done an immoral thing, and there is no man living who has never looked upon a woman with desire, without desire. Atticus paused and took out his handkerchief. Then he took off his glasses and wiped them, and we saw another first. We had never seen him sweat. He was one of those men whose faces never perspired, but now it was shining tan. One more thing, gentlemen, before I quit. Thomas Jefferson once said that all men are created equal, a phrase that the Yankees and the distaff side of executive branch of Washington are fond of hurling at us. There is a tendency in this year of grace, 1935, for certain people to use this phrase out of context, to satisfy all conditions. The most ridiculous example I can think of is that the people who run public education promote the stupid and idle along with the industrious. Because all men are created equal, educators will gravely tell you that children left behind suffer terrible feelings of inferiority. We know all men are not created equal in the sense some people would have us believe. Some people are smarter than others. Some people may have more opportunity because they're born with it. Some people make more money than others. Some ladies make better cakes than others. Some are born gifted beyond the normal scope of most men. But there is one way in this country in which all men are created equal. There is one human institution that makes a pauper the equal of a Rockefeller, the stupid man the equal of an Einstein, and the ignorant man the equal of any college president. That institution, gentlemen, is a court. It can be the Supreme Court of the United States or the humblest J.P. court in the land, or this honorable court which you serve. Our courts have their faults, as does any human institution, but in this country our courts are the great levelers, and in our courts all men are created equal. I'm no idealist to believe firmly in the integrity of our courts and in the jury system. That is no ideal to me. It is a living, working reality. Gentlemen, a court is no better than each man of you sitting before me on this jury. A court is only as sound as its jury, and a jury is only as sound as the men who make it up. I am confident that you gentlemen will review without passion the evidence you have heard, come to a decision, and restore this defendant to his family. In the name of God, do your duty. Atticus's voice had dropped, and as he turned away from the jury, he said something I did not catch. He said it more to himself than to the court. I punched Jim. What'd he say? In the name of God, believe him. I think that's what he said. Still suddenly reached over and tugged at Jim. Look a yonder. We followed his finger with sinking hearts. Calpurnia was making her way up the middle aisle, walking straight toward Atticus. Thanks for listening to these two chapters. Please hit that red subscribe button down below or click on my picture up above to subscribe to my channel so that I can continue to make more audiobooks.